out of ritual here, because normally in the ritual of our church, we would talk about communion next week, not this week, because next week's the first Sunday of the month, not this week. So just as Royce has put us into February, I've put us somewhere else as well. So imagine this. Instead of having communion in the context of a church service, we had communion at the conclusion or end of a shared meal. Imagine having communion after a culture night, where we celebrated the differences which contribute to the oneness of us as a church. Our tables would still be filled with the dishes and meals shared and prepared. There'd be dirty plates, half-filled glasses. There'd be nothing clean about our communion table. And then someone would say, "Now that we're finished feasting our bodies, let us remember the one who gave his body for us so that we could have complete wholeness. Now that we've had enough to drink, let us raise our glasses, Gambi." It's Mandarin for cheers. "Let's raise our glasses in the remembrance of the one who spilled his blood for us as a redeeming sacrifice." Imagine doing that as part of a shared meal. How easy would it be for each of us to take communion out of the cleanliness of the church service? The lace-covered cloth, the communion trays, the pre-cut bread, and have it as a final course of a full-blown meal. How comfortable would we feel in this context? What would it reveal about ourselves and our church and the way that we do life together? Now, I want to suggest that over time, communion has become more and more sanitised. I've completely lost my place. Jesus never said, "Have a ritual set apart in an order of a service called communion." He never said, "Have a ritual as part of a church service." Now, he did call us to a ritual of communion, but he demonstrated, and the Corinthian church demonstrated, that ritual would be ingrained in everyday love and life. So before we jump to Corinthians, let's look at the context of the first communion. What we do know is that the first communion between Jesus and the disciples did not happen in a church. It did not happen in a synagogue. In fact, it was honoured at a traditional time, the feast of the Passover. And the Passover feast always happened. It always happened in the order of life and love, not the order of a service. The Passover meal was one that happened within families and between families, in people's homes. In people's homes. And this was the case with the first communion. Matthew 26 and Luke 22 have the disciples asking Jesus, "Where do you want us to make preparations for the Passover?" And Jesus responds, "Go ahead into the city to a certain man, a man who is unnamed, a random man of history, but a significant man." Jesus says, "Go to this random but significant man's house and tell him, 'We'll be sitting at your table tonight.'" It was during this time, a time of 7 days, and at the conclusion of a meal, the Passover meal, when the table would still be filled with the remnants of that meal, the bones and the head of a roasted lamb, unleavened bread and bitter herbs, along with glasses of wine in front of each disciple. From this table, not a clean table, Jesus would pick up the unleavened bread, thread that we learn in Deuteronomy 16:6, this is one of the big learnings for me this week, read that symbolized the affliction of the Israelites as they left Egypt. Jesus would pick up the bread of affliction. He would pick this bread up and he would proclaim in the breaking of that bread that he would carry the affliction and the brokenness of us all. And he shared it. Each disciple taking a piece, he would pick up a glass of wine from that same dirty table and he would speak into it. This wine, an added addition to the Passover meal, would carry the symbolism of blood and a new covenant. The first communion was an order of life and love. Communion was more than something to be built into an order of service. It was to be built into a love for our God and for each other. A remembrance event to be had at the table and not at the altar. It is important to remember this as we approach today's reading from 1 Corinthians, because these verses will make so much more meaning and sense if we read them in the context of the church Paul was writing to, not the church today. So 1 Corinthians 11:17 to 34, and I'll be reading from the Passion Translation. This is Paul speaking. "Now, on this next matter, I wish I could commend you, but I cannot. Because when you meet together as a church family, it is doing more harm than good. I've been told many times that when you meet as a congregation, divisions and cliques emerge. And to some extent, this doesn't surprise me. Differences of opinion are unavoidable, yet they will reveal which ones of you have truly got God's approval. When you gather as one church family, you're not really properly celebrating the Lord's Supper. For when it comes time to eat, some gobble down their food before anything is given to others. One is left hungry while others become drunk. Don't you all have homes where you can eat and drink? Don't you realize that you're showing a superior attitude by humiliating those who have nothing? Are you trying to show contempt for God's beloved church? How should I address this appropriately? If you're looking for my approval, you won't find it. I have handed down to you what came to me direct revelation from the Lord himself. That same night in which he was handed over, he took bread and he gave thanks. Then he distributed it to the disciples and said, 'Take it and eat your fill. It is my body which is given for you. Do this to remember me.' He did the same with the cup of wine after supper and said, 'This cup seals the new covenant with my blood. Drink it. And whenever you drink this, do it to remember me. Whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you're retelling the story, proclaiming our Lord's death until he comes. For this reason, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in the wrong spirit will be guilty of dishonoring the body and blood of the Lord. So let each individual evaluate his own attitude and only then eat the bread and drink the cup, for continually eating and drinking with a wrong spirit will bring judgment upon yourself by not recognizing the body. This insensitivity is why many of you are weak, chronically ill, and some even dying. If we have examined ourselves, we should not be judged. But when we are judged, it is the Lord's training so that we will not be condemned along with the world. So then, my fellow believers, when you assemble as one to share a meal, show respect for one another and wait for all to be served. If you are hungry, eat at home first, so that when you gather together, you'll not bring judgment upon yourself. When I come to you, I will answer the other questions you have asked me in your letter." Please do not ask me what those other questions are. Okay, so Let's put these verses into context with the understanding that Paul is talking about communion as an order of life and love, not an order of service. If we try to relate these verses to our ritual of communion today, they just don't seem to fit. And to be perfectly honest, can lead some, like me, into misunderstanding the purpose of these verses. So let's break this passage down. In short, there are three sections. The first section deals with the church at Corinth as it prepares for communion. The second section focuses on communion itself. And the third, the needed response in preparation. Now, I want to suggest that many of us read these verses with a focus on communion and our response. We don't focus on the preparation verses. There is a very simple reason for this. The preparation verses clearly position the Lord's table in a different way, in a very different way than we're used to. It is clear that communion is more than what we are used to here. There is no way in our church that there's going to be those that miss out on bread. They're cut into nice little squares so that we can each have a piece. And there's certainly no way that we're getting drunk on Ribena juice while others miss out. Reading their verses in this, their fullness, suggests that communion in Corinth happened during a much bigger meal. A sharing of people coming together to share food and take communion together. Paul makes it clear it is no ordinary meal. If it was, you could have it in your own home. It was a communal meal. Commentaries would tell us that a common practice of the early church was something called the love feast. This is a time for the church to come together in brotherly love to celebrate differences and the fact that the cross brings unity and healing. Bread would be broken, wine would be drunk, but not to exclude others or in an act of drunkenness, but an understanding that Christ's body had become the bread of affliction and his blood the new covenant. The church became one with Christ at the cross in all of its diversity. But Paul was dismayed at the Corinthian church. Instead of coming together in love, they allowed the divisions that divided them to come to the Lord's table. And we know from the beginning of the letter that these divisions were real. Some said they followed the ways of Paul. Others said they followed the ways of Apollos. Some even followed the ways of Jesus. Some said that sexual indulgence in the church was normal and okay. Some accused others of having debt against them. Others refused to lower themselves and their beliefs because of those who were younger in their faith. The divisions were real. These divisions don't actually appear at our communion table today, not in the way that we do it, because we separate it from a meal. We're not having communion as part of a meal. We have it typically as an order of service, not as an order of life and love. We also do communion today very privately. Even if we take the elements together, we really don't engage in testimony and discussion over the elements. It's a very quiet affair, often with music playing in the background. But this doesn't mean that we're any better. It doesn't even mean that the Corinthian church was any better than us. It doesn't mean that the human condition today has improved since the time Paul wrote this letter. Just look at our children and shared lunches. You'll see the same thing happening. Now, back in the day when I was a lot younger and I was growing up in a state house in Westport, we would have shared lunches at school often. And the school would do that so that we could celebrate our differences. And Mum was incredibly poor, but she always wanted to make sure that we looked good. So she would make us cinnamon buns or white bait fritters. The white bait was always done to Granddad's secret recipe. And when we took our plate to school, we had strict instructions from Mum. The food was not ours. It was food to be shared, first and foremost. Mum would say we were not to take from our plate that we bought. Now, other kids would bring a variety of dishes, but three things were apparent at Westport South School. The most popular kids always got their first choice and their fill, while the poorest and most rejected kids were lucky to get something at all. Some families would bring the best possible plate to school, but as soon as the lunch started, the kids would quickly sneak to the table, grab the plate to take home after school. They weren't sharing their food with anyone. Shared lunches at Westport South School did not foster unity. They just showed power and inequity. We could take from this that the church at Corinth was no better than Westport South School. But I want to suggest that both demonstrate two very real issues with our broken human condition. The first is a sense of entitlement. There are times in which some feel entitled to be first at the table, entitled to be seen above others, entitled to be acknowledged. I remember Royce preaching a few sermons on who Jesus would see as the best disciple, you know, the most important disciple. There are times that we feel entitled to be seen. The other issue of our human condition that leads to division at moments of shared communion is the flip side of entitlement, and that's a blindness to inequity. When you feel entitled to something and you use that argument, you're more likely to be, in that moment, blind to inequity, blind to those who are less fortunate, blind to those who are different to you. That's exactly what was happening in the preparedness of the love feast at the Lord's table of the Corinthian church. Division meant some felt more entitled to a place at the table and the food and the drink being served. This entitlement led to inequity and some missing out because of the conditions set by the entitled. Paul would say, and I find this verse really powerful, "Don't you realise that you're showing a superior attitude by humiliating those who have nothing?" If you want a table of entitlement, set it up in your own homes, because at the Lord's table there is a seat for everyone. And if everyone is treated as equal, then gluttony and drunkenness would be non-existent because everyone would be sharing. After all, reading Luke 22, Jesus even broke bread and shared communion, shared wine with Judas. There was a place at Jesus' table for Judas. I would suggest that we cannot judge ourselves better or worse than the Corinthian church as we prepare for the table of communion. But I would say that any divisions that exist in our church, and we do have divisions and difference, then the way we manage these conditions don't happen in the order of a church service, where we're all nice to each other. The way we manage division and difference happens in the order of life and love. So how do we do life and love together? I'm really thankful that I got these verses and not the ones that Bruce got last week, because thankfully we're not working with the tricky verses of last week. Verses about gender, worship and the head, and whether I should have long or short hair. And I have tried to grow long hair, but it just becomes afro. So you're not going to get long hair with me, you're just going to get afro. Thankfully, these verses make plain, simple sense, don't they? This is logical. This is how you do communion. You know, this whole concept of communion hasn't changed at all, has it? It's been a sacrament, it's right back in Jesus' time, it's still celebrated now, you know, that 2,000 years? Pretty good. Thankfully, we can forget about context with these scriptures and just focus on the content. Thankfully, communion is something that we've never, ever had doctrinal arguments about. Realistically, just as communion divided the church in Corinth, over centuries, the church has become divided over communion. I was going to bring it today, but my father has given me a silver dish, and it's got the silver thing on the middle. It's his first communion thingy, Bob. I don't know what they call it in the Anglican church, but my father got to have his first communion at the age of 12 in a denomination which believed that children should not have communion until they understood it, and that the bread became the body, and that the wine became the blood. My first experience of church as a child was a denomination which refused to have communion. Not because it disagreed with communion, but because it was a denomination which drew in the broken, often those who had been part of other churches. So in order to reduce the arguments about difference, leadership early on made the decision that it was best to focus on unity than to have communion, which would cause disunity. I can't help but think the way we do communion in our own church and in others has been a direct response to issues such as, how do you ensure that everyone is able to take part? How do you ensure that everyone has a piece of bread? Well, you cut it up to begin with, and it stops a person taking off a big piece of bread. And then the person at the end of the line gets no bread. How do you deal with drunkenness? Well, you use Ribena juice. It's just logical. How do you ensure that there are no arguments? Well, that's very simple. You just restrict those who speak. And you predominantly do communion in silence with nice music playing in the background. Stop the discussion, and then you've just got everyone doing this, just being toeing the line, no arguments, nothing happened. Now, I'm not saying that the way we do communion today is wrong, but I am saying that if Paul was picking on anything in the Corinthian church, it was often, remember, these verses are about worship, okay? These verses are about worship, and often we confine worship to music. Worship is the whole of our life, you know? If Paul was picking up on anything in the Corinthian church, it was often that practices of worship, starting with communion, have the risk of dividing us. There have been so many arguments about worship and how to do worship. So many arguments. You know, when I was growing up, it was like, one week you were allowed to have drums, next week they were the thing of Satan. And you had to get rid of them. All drums were gone, you know? I'm just picking on the music side of it. You know, just even the way that we do church now is so different. But some people would come in here and say, well, this is not the way that I like to do church. I'm going over there. Worship divides. That's really sad. It's really, really sad because it's our opinion that's happening there. Paul says amongst all of us, you know, the time that I'll turn around and say, you know, DC Talk is the greatest Christian band of all time, da da da. Paul was saying something really, really pertinent here. You know, when we take on that attitude that we know best, that we know how to do worship best, don't you realise that showing a superior attitude by humiliating those who have nothing? You know, when we think we've got the right answer, we're humiliating others. It's not the humbleness that's been called for at the cross. We kneel at the dust at the foot of the cross where mercy paid for us. We are no better than the dust. Now, a few months ago, I suggested that the whole of 1 Corinthians was a call to love. What's love got to do with it? It's a call to deep love and agape love, a love that demonstrates compassion and deepness of the love of God for his creation. When I put communion into the context of the Church of Corinth, I suggested that this occurred at a time of shared feasting, a common feast and an act of worship called the love feast, the agape feast. It's contradiction when you think about bringing all this division into a shared table, bringing this division into a table called agape, compassionate love. Today we do communion very differently. And one suggestion I have made is that we've potentially made communion too white and too pure. I've suggested that we tend to be inward in communion. In the last communion, Lisa reminded us that communion was a call to common unity. I want to suggest that the only way we can achieve common unity is through deep and intentional acts of life and love. The only way that we can really come to common unity is by knowing each other. By knowing each other. And I mean knowing. Like if anyone's watched the movie Avatar and the person on Avatar says, I see you, that's the type of knowing, when you can actually see, when we actually see each other's spirit. For all of it, it is. Now, I want to finish with a hint that I made when I started. And that is, for decades, I have misread these verses. Because I focused on content. Now, remember, the secret to reading the Bible is context, 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 then content. For close to 30 years, I have been focusing on content. And occasionally I'll pull a part of these verses out to read if I'm going to be sharing communion with you. I haven't put those verses into context. So here's something that I have misread. So each individual must first evaluate his own attitude and only then eat the bread and drink the cup. For continually eating and drinking with a wrong spirit will bring judgment upon yourself by not recognising the body. This insensitivity is why so many of you are weak, chronically ill, and some even dying. You see, when I have read these verses, I have focused on only one relationship, that of myself with God, and my own attitude towards God. I've only focused that way. And when I've struggled in my faith, when I've hit those obstacles, I have actively not had communion because I've judged myself as having the wrong attitude. But if I read these verses in the context of this chapter, in the context of this letter, the attitude, and hear me here, the attitude Paul is asking us to evaluate is the attitude we have to each other. Attitudes of entitlement, attitudes of selfishness, attitudes of being blind to the iniquities in our church, attitudes of judgment and bias. Paul was warning me, do not, if your attitude is wrong, if you have got something against someone in the church, fix it up. Do not engage at the Lord's table in a mockery with a mask on. Fix your attitude up with each other. Fix the divisions up with each other. Come to the table in common unity. And you can only come to the table in common unity if you know each other. How can you come to the table with strangers and claim to have unity? Get to know each other. Paul calls the church at Corinth back to the first principles of life and love. to come to the communion table, whether it be a feast or with little square bits of bread, to come to the table where there's division only leads to the church, our church, becoming sick, both physically and spiritually. The call to life and love is real, but are we ready to walk in the way of love? And don't just say yes, because 1 Corinthians 13 is a lot harder than we think. It's a lot harder than we think. It really requires us to use my philosophical language, to suspend ourselves, to take ourselves out of the picture and put each other in that picture. And that's a lot harder. It's a lot harder. It's very easy to say, I love you. It's a lot harder to live the verb, to actually do it. It's a lot harder than we think. And we've got to get it right in here first. We have to get it right in here first. Because if we haven't got it right in here, how can we live in a way of love out there? Because the world is looking at us. The world sees us. You know, every time I go to work and I say something against my church, the world sees that. I'm not saying I do that. But every time, you know, we will be judged. And that is a fact. So are we really prepared as we're moving? You know, we're at 1 Corinthians 11 now. We're going to get to that pinnacle, 13, where Paul says, without love, I am nothing. Are we really prepared to come to a table in common unity where we deeply love each other in all of our brokenness? Because I'm not the only broken one in here. We're all broken. You know? The cross is a powerful symbol for us. When I put this sermon together, one of the most powerful things that came to me in this was understanding about the bread. Understanding that the bread is the bread of affliction. Jesus said, as Roy said to us when he gathered the disciples together, I want to share with you before I suffer. The affliction that Jesus carried for us is real. The new covenant that he signed in with his blood is real. Don't let us underrate it. Let us be committed to getting to know each other deeply. Amen. Deeply, deeply, deeply. Let us walk in a way of love together. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tērā tātou katoa.